This is The Guardian.
I'm Noor Haider, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is the full story. News of the first shark bite in New South Wales this summer came on Sunday.
While a 12-year-old boy is fighting for life in hospital after being attacked by a large shark in Sydney Harbour.
Then on Monday, there was another.
A young surfer has escaped injury after a shark bit a chunk of his board on Sydney's northern.
Later that same afternoon, a 27-year-old surfer was bitten.
Sydney's third attack in just 2 days. The unconscious surfer was pulled from the water and given first aid on the stand in.
And then on Tuesday morning, a 39-year-old surfer escaped serious injury after his surfboard was bitten on the mid-north coast. Nearly 30 beaches have been temporarily closed in response, and authorities are warning swimmers to avoid waterways.
We are more at risk for these shark attacks. So I would say to swimmers and surfers, give it a rest today, don't go in the water.
The spate of shark bites has unnerved even the most experienced surfers.
They got to put some more money into this and actually get on top of it. Whether it's drones, jet skis, do something. Like, it's not okay being scared.
I'm probably going to start paying more attention to how much it rains, how murky the water is.
It's happening too often now, which isn't good, and we always live around the beach, and for this to happen right at home is, like, pretty scary.
So what's contributed to this cluster of shark bites, and what can be done? Today, Chris Pepin-Neff, Associate Professor of Public Policy at the University of Sydney and author of the book Flaws, Shark Bites and Emotional Public Policymaking. It's Thursday, the 22nd of January. Chris, welcome to Full Story.
Thank you so much.
You've researched shark attacks in Australia and around the world. This week, there's been 4 in 48 hours. As an expert in this field, what was your reaction as news of each one of these attacks came through? Were you shocked that there were so many in quick succession?
So my answer is going to be yes. And I think it's an even bigger yes than it usually is, because I specifically study clusters of 3 or more that pop up in places. But the velocity of this 4 in 48 hours is a lot for any location in the world. And it's the most I've ever seen in 4 separate places, even though we're still in Sydney. It's the most I've ever seen. And I think it speaks to, and I don't want to get ahead of the game here, but it speaks to the fact that environmental conditions, that there's a common denominator in the environmental situation that's extreme. It's clearly extreme, but I think there's probably one common denominator that contributes to a cluster of this kind.
Mm. And I do want to talk about those environmental factors. Many, including yourself, suspect that there were bull sharks involved. Could you first begin by explaining the behavior of bull sharks and the characteristics of this particular species and how it differs from others?
So I can. I'm just going to make sure I preface everything by noting that my background, I've got 4 degrees, but 3 of them are in shark bite politics and policy making, but I'm not specifically a marine biologist, but I've done 20 years of this, and this is what I write and publish on. So I feel comfortable talking about it. So bull sharks are smaller. So you've got great whites that are big, and you know, of the more than 500 species, you've got bull sharks, tiger sharks, great white sharks, and I'd probably include oceanic white tips in there as the dangerous ones we need to really pay more attention to. And bull sharks, which are, you know, sometimes they're sort of in the bronze whaler family. So you could have dusky sharks, bull sharks. So they're mid-size and they're mesopredators. So they're under the great white sharks. So what that means is that their behavior is different than what we would expect from a great white. So for instance, great whites, because they're so big, they maximize energy. So there's usually one bite and they run off, right? And that's because the moment they're teeth touch something, it registers, we're very bony. It's mostly biting us and spitting us out. Bull sharks are different. Their anatomy is different. And because they're smaller, they bite more often. It's sort of it's a weird story where the smaller they are, the more that they bite because they're looking for fat, basically, to make it worth their while to be doing it. But they're also defensive. And because bull sharks function in low salinity, so they go in fresh water and in salt water, they occupy just different places than white sharks or tiger sharks will go. And so you can see them more in bays and inlets and estuaries and rivers and obviously in Sydney Harbor. And the reason that they're particularly active during a rainstorm is that when the fresh water rains into it, it mixes right with the salt water and it creates, it's not a fjord, right? Where if you were in, I don't know if everybody knows what a fjord is, but it's sort of where you've got like an inch of fresh water and then a lot of salt water. That is a different environment and kind of ecosystem. And it's kind of a little biodiversity explosion that happens. And those environments attract lots of bait fish. There's lots of stuff to feed on. And so when you have a heavy rainstorm and you have that kind of environment, that is a ring in the bell for bull sharks to come and hang out because they can sustain those low salinity environments.
Mm. You've identified some key factors that you say have contributed to this spate of attacks. Can you take us through each of them?
So, you know, one other thing I would say just with bull sharks that leads us into this is that because they're in these environments, so in these cases, so if I went one case to the four, so in the first case, we're in Sydney Harbor, there's a heavy rain. We know bull sharks are more abundant at 45 millimeters of rain. That's if there's 45 millimeters of rain in a general area, there's a higher likelihood to see bull sharks. In this case, we had 125 millimeters of rain. So we've got three times that. So we would expect that there would be bull sharks. There's also in the harbor, the sewage outfalls that have overflowed because the old pipes are there. So there's just a lot of excitement in bait fish activity. So you've got the heavy rain, the garbagey water in the attractant for bull sharks. So bull sharks are attracted to the area. And because the bait fish are toward the surface, bull sharks are drifted toward the surface.
But have we not experienced those conditions, the murky water, the warmer water in summers gone by without seeing this many shark attacks?
This is a great question. And this is the question that sort of kept me up last night. And I was talking to a number of different colleagues about this, that Sydney gets lots of rainstorms. People go surfing. People jump off rocks. This doesn't happen. Why is it happening now? I think there's an attractant element that we have not yet fully figured out. So the bull sharks were there because they were feeding on something, right? And that's kind of the issue, is that when you bump into a bull shark and it's already excited and it's already feeding on something, it's going to bite. The usual guess to somebody who studies clusters of shark bites is water temperature. Like, it's like the perfect water temperature for the bait fish, the perfect water temperature for the bull sharks, and a reasonable temperature for human activity to go in. And if you merge all three of those plus a rainstorm, but again, your point is like, hasn't that happened before? And it probably has. But I do think that there's an attractant. It could be something as simple as there was a sardine run that didn't run last year because of El Nino and it ran this year. So when the big storm came, it stirred stuff up. My guess, and we're not supposed to do guessing, but I just want to communicate with the public during a time of distress. My guess is that in 12 months, once they've done an assessment of the harbor and of the ocean beaches, that it's going to be something like that, that something got stirred up that there wasn't a lot of last year. But it's this common variable and the storm started up and the water temperature was correct. And that got everything extra excited.
Do you think the climate crisis and rising sea temperatures will increase these sorts of incidents?
Yes. So We see this over the trend lines. We were talking about like the trend lines on the catch data for bull sharks. Well, the trend lines on water temperature in coastal areas and the shift in movements because of water temperature are dramatic and incredibly significant. You could set up a shark activity forecast on a weather map around water temperature deviations and just follow the line in its, in the water temperature. It just moves the sharks inshore. And over the last number of years, let's say 10 years, the whole water column has moved because in the water temperature is warmer closer in. So, and I don't think we often talk about that enough because you've got environments where the temperature is warm outside and the surface temperature of the water is also affected. And that those two combinations are guaranteeing that there will be a rise in shark bites, right? We're not going to have to worry about the population of sharks because the amount of people that go in the water, that's going to be so much higher in extreme heat conditions, is going to increase that rate in and of itself.
We'll be right back. I want to talk about the response. Authorities have moved to temporarily shut some beaches. People are being advised not to get into the water while it's as murky as it is. What else from a policy response perspective do you think should be done here?
I think shutting the beaches is a great idea. I think people shouldn't be swimming, whether it's because there's raw sewage in the overflow in the harbor or because there are bull sharks in the harbor or on the ocean beaches, is a great idea. There's tons of runoff. It's a dangerous time. They should wait 3 days to go in the harbor and 2 days to go to the ocean beach. That's the rule. In terms of policy responses specifically, I think we've got to be mindful of the environmental conditions. So what I mean is drones are not a great idea when the water is brown. The drone's not going to see anything. So you can put as many drones in the air as you want to, and if the water is foamy, it's not going to see anything. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I know people have been talking about, you know, websites and tracking and things like that. And I just would say that the existing websites do not track sharks in real time. So the shark is not there when you see it on the website. So the shark is not waiting for you to check the website. It's swimming around and it keeps moving. So it's not really a real time way to do business. In terms of other policies, you know, people are talking about culling and things like that. Again, I do this all over the world at clusters. Reunion Island, Recife, Brazil, Hawaii. Culling doesn't work if there's an attractant in the water. What I'm saying is there's an attractant in the water. So if you don't kill every single shark, the attractant is still there, and then another shark can come and pose a risk. So what you need to do is either stay out of the water while there's an attractant, or wait for it to pass, and you wait for the 3 days for the ocean kind of to reset itself after a big storm. And then you do the drones and you check it out, but you don't go in the water while there's an attractant in the water. And that's something tangible that we can do safely today. And I think that would be a policy priority.
Mm. You've mentioned a couple of things that you don't believe are effective. I wanted to ask you about shark nets. The state premier, Chris Minns, says there's no way that the nets will be removed now. We know there's been a long-running debate in New South Wales about the use of shark nets. Are they effective in preventing incidents like this, in your view?
Shark nets are not effective at preventing incidents, period. And there's no data and no science that they've had 100 years to give me one study. I've been doing this for 20 years. I can point to 5 studies that show that gill nets, which is what a shark net is, catch sharks in other bait fish and other bycatch. And that when those things that are caught in the net flail around, the struggle sends out a vibration that attracts sharks to the nets. Another attractant that we haven't talked about, right? That nets are attractants as well. So I can give you 5 studies that show that gill nets attract sharks to the beach, and they can't give me one study in 100 years that shows that shark nets are good at reducing the rate of shark bites. And I mean, it would be quite a reasonable question, I think, to ask given the young a boy who had the board bitten at DY, the gentleman who is, again, in very serious condition at Manly, of whether there were shark nets at those beaches, because they both of those beaches have shark nets. And we know there was a shark net in the water when Mercury Sakakis terribly and tragically died last year. So I would be very interested to hear the evidence from Tara Moriarty about shark nets at Manly and DY this week. From everything I know, it was my understanding that they were there. So this argument that, you know, doubling down on the great value of shark nets during a moment of distress when the public is trying to figure out answers, I think that is certainly a choice, but it's a choice that is not consistent with the science.
Mm. You've researched and even written a book about emotional policymaking after shark attacks. I wonder if there are things that you would caution against or advise against, or things that you would advocate for in this moment.
You know, I think public education and telling people the truth matters. So it's not just stormy water. There's also sewage that from 100-year-old pipes at Sydney Harbor. We don't talk about that. We don't advertise when there's a heavy rain and it's going to affect bull shark movements. Bull sharks, before a big storm like a hurricane or a cyclone or some other kind of big weather event, will also hide in estuaries to protect themselves before the storm comes. So it could be that the 3 days before a storm are more dangerous than the 3 days after the storm. But we don't talk about that either. So if you live on Parramatta River, where we've had terrible incidents as well, we don't tell them to be careful on the sunny day 3 days before the storm. So there's just the lack of proper communication to educate the public in 2026 about a summer in Sydney and sharks is wild. It's wild to me. And I get pushback from the government whenever I make these points. But we know these are known knowns about risk levels. We could have a green, yellow, red code for rainstorms and shark bites, like two for fires, to let people know that now it's not a good time. Because, you know, I think one of the issues with shark bites is that they don't, and it's terrible that they obviously affect the person who's bitten, but they affect whole communities. People are traumatized and it affects really the whole community. So I would have a whole of community approach to educating it, especially because there are some, you know, I often say that storms make for big waves and bad sharks, right? That the surfers love the big waves. The problem is that you can end up with bad shark bites. And I think they're, so that you've got to have like targeted messaging, not just like the general red, yellow, green, but then outreach to surfers that says, okay, it's going to be great. There's going to be nobody out there. The waves are going to be huge and we need you to stay home.
Mm.
And it's just dirty water and this would not be a good time. But we don't do any of that. Instead, we say, oh, we're definitely not going to take out shark nets now. Oh, it's sort of reaffirming the good decision we made before to leave them in so that they would bait, and, you know, bait beaches and potentially attract sharks closer to shore. Or we're going to do the website, which doesn't give real time information, that they're leaning into those and away from these public education things that I think actually support people and keep them safe.
I wanted to ask you on an individual level, what would your advice be for someone who has the unfortunate experience of coming face to face with a bull shark?
So the number one thing is to always keep eye contact with the animal. So you never want to turn your back on the wild animal. That's rule number one. So you've got to look it in the eye. The shark knows that you're looking at it. So what you try to do is, and if you turn your back and swim, you're in danger. That is a terrible idea. So what you want to do is you always stay facing it and you swim backwards toward the shore to use the shoreline as your defense. So you swim backwards toward the shore. if you're bitten, you need to get out of the water as soon as humanly possible. So my point is not if you've already been bitten to like slowly swim backwards. That's not the point I'm making. I'm saying that if you see the shark and you're still okay, then you try to get out of its way by continuing to face it and swim backwards. But if you're bitten, you need to get out of the water as fast as possible. And they're opportunistic biters. So being in cleaner water is better than dirty water, right? Dirty water is the advantage to the shark. So you always want to move toward the shore. You always want to move to the clean water. You always want to face the shark.
Chris Pepin-Neff, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Associate Professor Chris Pepin-Neff from Sydney University. And if you'd like to read more, we've linked to The Guardian's latest coverage on the full story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria. Sound design and mixing by Camilla Hannan. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. If you like this episode, don't forget you can subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also leave us a review. I'm Nord Haydar. Thanks for listening.